quite unexpectedly, we find ourselves in a patch of decomposing plastic polymers about the size of North America. This giant swirl of plastic garbage leads us to ask, is it possible to throw plastic away?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 949th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Punta Arenas who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Aaron Shore on the controls. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
So where's that guest of ours?
Apparently he's not picking up.
Well, we'll have to work on it and pick him up here in a few. Aaron, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Is it possible to throw plastic away?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, that's what we're going to explore today. Aaron, also, guess what? Producer Kelly Bear is heading off to Israel for a whole, months and months and months. And so we're appreciative of her service here today. So we're going to have her kind of host along with me today pick it up. Miss Kelly, take it away.
All right. Well, folks, out there in the oceans of the world where the fish we will eat in the future lives, there exists giant eddies of decomposing trash that some say are as big as North America. In truth, these patches are hard to see by the casual observer or by satellites high in the sky, as they are made up of tiny nodules of decomposing plastic polymers that grow in size as one approaches the center of the spiraling vortex of currents. Nevertheless, the patches of trash are huge and cover large extents of the ocean, and so lead us to ask, to what extent does plastic trash inhabit our oceans? Does this decomposing trash find its way back into our food chain? What can be done, if anything, to ameliorate the damage of our plastic trash on our oceans? And is it really possible to throw plastic away?
Well, guess what? We have a guest. You want to introduce your guest?
All right. Today we have Captain Charles Moore, founder of the Algolita Marine Research Institute and author of Plastic Ocean, How a Sea Captain's Chance Discovery Launched a Determined Quest to Save the Oceans. Welcome to the Food Chain, Captain Moore.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So you've got two of us here today. You have producer Kelly Bayer and Michael Olson, the host, and we're pleased to have you aboard.
Yeah, well, what kind of ship am I sailing on?
A 10,000-watt ship that sails all over the world, and that's where your voice will be carried today. Hey, producer Kelly Bear says that you have two different professions. What are they, Kelly?
I heard that you're a farming sea captain. What's that like?
Well, in 1994, I've been organic gardening and farming since 1974, and I helped start the Long Beach Food Co-op, and now run the Gladys Avenue Urban Farm. Started after reading a book called Ruth Stout's No Work Garden Book, and she was an East Coast gardener that would mulch with straw in the fall, and then in the spring she would just pull apart the straw mulch and plant right there directly in the ground under the mulch, and that was her no-work method. There was no weeding, tilling, anything like that. And I thought, well, I can handle that. So we got a bunch of tree trimmings from Edison and built piles of mulch. Since we don't have winter out here with snow in Southern California, we just put a little planting mix on top of the mulch pile and planted from the top down, and it turned out it worked really good. So I was doing that for 20 years, and decided, well, you know, we've got a lot of issues going on in the ocean, a lot of issues going on with the land. There's a land and sea connection. The way to the way to keep runoff from getting into the ocean and building up and causing eutrophication and damaging the marine environment is to grow things organically, like Roustelle did, have things soften the urban hardscape, is what we call the major concept, and keep runoff from getting into the ocean. So in 1994, I founded two organizations. One was Long Beach Organic, which was dedicated to turning vacant lots into community gardens, and the other was Algolita Marine Research, which was dedicated to studying and remediating damage to the ocean. And it was not until 1997 that we really started focusing more on the offshore environment, because that's the year that I sailed back from Hawaii after building my research vessel and found the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. So after that, the focus shifted from the coastal ocean to the deep ocean, but we still believe that it's stopping the runoff of plastic trash to the ocean that's winding up in the deep ocean that we need to do to protect the ocean. We don't believe in these end-of-the-pipe solutions of, making a big mess and then trying to clean it up. The messes that we're making as humans now are too large for cleanup to work. So we've got to stop it at the source, and that's why I do both farming and sailing. And this voyage we're making back 15 years on from the discovery of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and monitoring it 15 years from the discovery date, will be supplied for the first time the major staples for the voyage, the potatoes, the onions, the garlic, the carrots, a lot of the vegetables will be grown at my Gladys Avenue urban farm. So we're in the ground now, or we've got our snow peas peeking out, and we're looking forward to a good harvest in the spring.
Wonderful. So will you be composting your food scraps while you're out at sea?
When we're out at sea, we do have a compost bucket, right? But when we fill that bucket up, like at home here, we'd go from the bucket to the compost pile. But out at sea, we don't have the capacity to make a compost pile. We do have sprouting capability, and we will be doing a lot of sprouting because we'll be gone for almost 2 months, and that's a long time. But fresh produce does keep, if you handle it properly, and we've never had a voyage where we've run out of fresh produce, but we do plan to do a lot of sprouting.
Well, cool. I was wondering if you could tell us about your epiphany moment when you were out at sea for the first time in 1997, traveling from Hawaii to California, and you went off course, right, and went into the North Pacific current gyre, and then did you all of a sudden realize you were in a garbage patch, or?
No, it was not an aha moment or an epiphany in that sense. A lot of science is based on accumulated information that leads to a hypothesis, you know, and this was just a slow awakening based on the fact that there was stuff out where it didn't belong. I mean, here we are as far really as you can get from human civilization on the planet, out halfway between Hawaii and the mainland, which is over 1,000 miles from land. And I couldn't come on deck without seeing some evidence of civilization floating by, a bottle cap or a shard of plastic. And
this was for weeks on end?
Day after day after day after day after day, going, well, look, it's not some kind of plastic children's story out here where we're being led back to port by some ferry that's thrown plastic chips out here and making a trail to lead us home. This is not what's going on here. We're in the middle of a huge weather phenomenon called the North Pacific High, and the North Pacific High pressure atmospheric phenomenon is in this latitude is often, you know, half the size of the Pacific Ocean itself. It's a big gyre, a rotating current caused by this high-pressure cell, which is created at the equator by the heat of the sun building up the atmospheric heat load and raising the atmosphere. Any gas, including our atmosphere, it rises when it becomes warm. And
all right, well, we're going to have to pick this up after the break here. We're talking with Captain Moore, founder of the Algolita Marine Research Institute, and we're discussing the question of, can we really throw plastic away? Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
What's the phone number?
Oh, the phone number is 831-479-1080. You can also join us on the forums at metrofarm.com.
Who are you?
And I'm Kelly Bear, and we're on Michael Olson's The Food Chain Radio.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
All right, folks, this is Kelly Bayer, and we are talking with Captain Moore about the garbage in the ocean. And we were just talking about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, where all of our garbage, well, not all of our garbage, but some of our garbage ends up there. And we're kind of curious to the size of this garbage patch.
Well, it is kind of interesting why a large percentage of the persistent floating plastic trash, which is most consumer goods, are either polyethylene or polypropylene, which floats. There's plastics that sink, but the majority of consumer goods, the bags, the bottles, are made out of those two olefin plastics that float. And surprisingly, if they're dropped anywhere along the Pacific coast or the Asian coast, greater than 50% of it will wind up in a band called the convergence zone between about 200 or 300 miles off the coast of California and all the way to China. And the width of it is from about 20 degrees north latitude to about 40 degrees north latitude. So you're looking at an area about the size of the entire United States that where our trash converges. It converges because of descending air that was, as I mentioned before the break, was heated at the equator and then descends on its way to the pole in a clockwise rotation. And that clockwise rotation creates a clockwise current that takes 6 years to do a period of rotation. So that swirling vortex tends to drop trash into it. There are low-pressure gyres like the Gulf of Alaska. They spit the trash out, and then the high-pressure gyres suck it in. So our trash does end up in a band, convergence zone, between the offshore waters of California and the nearshore waters of Asia that is got in many areas more plastic bits than actual zooplankton, the food source of the ocean. And so we've created a new food chain, plastic food chain.
Can you expand on that? I heard a figure that there's like 6 times more plastic than zooplankton.
Yeah, that's our published result from 1999, and it's now changed. We're at 10 years on, we went back and found an average of 36 to 1, 6 times as much plastic as plankton. than what we had in our first study, 6-1. So it's gone from 6-1 to a, we had a winter, you know, some people wonder, well, does it change winter or summer? And we looked at that, and we didn't find that to be the case. What we found was it kind of changes based on how rough the ocean is. If the ocean is pretty disturbed, a lot of the little bits of plastic are driven down into the water column, and we don't catch them in our surface net. But there's so much out there that the weight has still gone up, even though the numbers of particles went down. So anyway, to make a long story short, the average between our winter study and our summer study 10 years after the 1999 study was 36-1 plastic to plankton. We're going to now survey it in three different states. One of the reasons we're spending a month out there is so we get different weather conditions and we can survey the area in calm, in moderate winds, and in heavier winds and get three different results to compare. But in general, what we're looking at is a situation in which the food web diagrams that are produced, which show, you know, the phytoplankton feeding the zooplankton, feeding the ichthyoplankton, the fish plankton, feeding the birds and mammals and large fish, all those trophic levels, those levels of different sizes of things that live and eat things in the ocean, are being now fooled into eating plastic, whether it's one of the great whales, doesn't matter if it's a baleen whale or a whale with teeth, all the way down to the planktonic level, every one of those trophic levels now we're finding plastic in the bodies of these animals. These animals are now consuming our waste, our trash, which has no nutrient value and, as a matter of fact, is a sponge for toxicants in the ocean.
And they can survive eating plastic, and they can even grow eating plastic, right?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we have some good evidence of that. My colleague, Dr. Marcus Erickson, although, you know, that doesn't mean the fish is edible in any sense. But
we do eat them.
Well, Dr. Erickson didn't. He drifted to Hawaii on a raft they made out of 3,000 plastic bottles called the Junk Raft. And that journey took him 3 months. And when you're drifting out in the ocean, you're an attractant for fish because you offer shelter. And mm-hmm. a typical fish offshore called the Rainbow Runner laid eggs there under their raft, and they watched these baby fish developed. They could see the egg sacs on them. And after 3 months, one was big enough to eat, the dominant one that had chased all the others back behind the raft and got every particle that came by first. They decided to catch it and eat it. They were getting hungry after 3 months running out of food, and they opened it up, and it was full of plastic, had 13 pieces of plastic in its stomach.
And so they decided, I don't want to eat this.
And knowing what they knew, the fact that plastic is a sponge for pollutants and transfers them into the tissue of the animal that eats them, a lot of these pollutants are carcinogens and mutagens and endocrine disruptors, meaning they look like hormones to your body, although they're unnatural. They attach to hormonal receptors. Knowing what they knew, hungry as they were, they still decided not to eat the fish. So about 35% of the fish we sampled out there in a published study had plastic in their stomachs. So, and another study done off the English coast in the English Channel found about a third of the fish having plastic in their stomach in a multi-species study. So we're involved in a study like that now on the Pacific coast. But basically what we're saying is that, hey, isn't this great? We found a new way to make sure that it's impossible to have an organic wild-caught fish.
Right. So if I'm eating salmon, do you think it has any plastic in it? From even if it didn't eat plastic, another fish that it ate or whatever fish, I don't know what salmon eat, but
Salmon, I'll tell you what, that's a very interesting question because Dr. Ebbesmeyer, who was one of the scientists that hypothesized the existence of this garbage patch before we discovered it, and he's the one that named it the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, he was asked by a salmon grower if he could grow his salmon organically and if that would then be released into the ocean and come back fat if he could call his fish inorganic salmon if he was very careful with the way he raised his brood stock. And Dr. Ebbesmeyer said no. And the reason he said no was that these plastics don't remain as whole objects and just float around out in the ocean. They break into little particles. And those particles then break down. And according to Dr. Andrade, you can't get a bacteria to really ingest this until it's around a 500 molecular weight. Plastics are in the tens of thousands molecular weight. So you've got to have chain scission. You've got to break these polymer chains into small bits for organisms to be able to eat them.
And plastic does break down enough.
That process is occurring in the ocean through photodegradation, not biodegradation. The ultraviolet rays of the sun embrittle the plastic and create these tiny chains. So one of the studies we want to conduct this voyage this next summer out to the gyre, where we're going to live with the plastic trash, also the trash from the Fukushima disaster, which may be radioactive, so we'll have Geiger counters on board to check that. We're going to really look at
this
water itself, just to see if the water has these tiny, invisible plastic, broken plastic chains that are invading every space in the ocean.
Well, we'll keep talking about this after the commercial break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. We're talking about plastics in the ocean with Captain Moore, and you can call to join in our discussion at 831-479-1080 or join us on the forums at metrofarm.com. Steve, do please stay tuned.
Who are you?
I'm Kelly Baer, and
who
this is Michael Olson's Food Chain Radio program. Well, folks, we're here talking with Captain Moore about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and wondering if we're ending up eating our own garbage. Good question. Well, Captain Moore, Farmer Sea Captain Moore, curious about who is throwing all this garbage away, and is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch the only garbage patch?
Well, there's no guiltless parties in the plastic age. You can't avoid it. Plastic is everywhere in our lives. It turns out our clothes are shedding thousands of plastic fibers every time we wash, and that the filters in the washing machine don't take them out, nor do the filters in the wastewater treatment plants take them out.
So is it just people on the coast that are putting this garbage in the ocean?
No, the ocean happens to have a certain location on the planet, which is downhill from every terrestrial location.
Uh-huh.
So, as a matter of fact, someone living in Colorado can easily have a tributary lead into a major river and thereby transmit their debris into the ocean. So, it's really from sea to summit is one of the ways we look at it. There's no way to stop escaped lightweight plastics from blowing and washing into the sea. These plastics escape from responsible consumers just as much as they do from irresponsible wastrels. And those plastics ending up in the ocean now constitute somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 million to 200 million tons.
And it doesn't all end up in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. There's other garbage patches?
These phenomena that I described, where the air is heated at the equator, it mm-hmm. doesn't just go north, it goes south too. So you have this situation in which warm air is displaced by cool air that rushes in to displace it, and that movement pushes the warm air cells both north and south of the equator. So we have the South Pacific Gyre, the North Pacific Gyre, the South Atlantic Gyre, the North Atlantic Gyre, and the Indian Ocean Gyre, and they correspond roughly to where you find desert areas on Earth, the Sahara Desert, the Gobi Desert, the Atacama Desert in South America. These desert regions are under high-pressure cells, and that is one of the reasons why we also call these gyres oceanic deserts, which means as we populate them with our trash, there's very little life there, and that's why we have such a high ratio of plastic to plankton in these gyres. Mm-hmm. And that means also that the creatures there are prone to eat the plastic because they're programmed to gather whatever food is out there. Most of the feeding in the ocean takes place by the animal sticking to the food. They're mucilaginous, jelly-like salps and larvations and jellies that touch things and thereby consume them rather than taste and look like we do and like mammals do and birds do. And have even birds that, you know, still are getting fooled. The albatrosses are being killed, hundreds of thousands of them every year, by feeding their babies plastic that they foraged out of the ocean. So it's fooling everything. It's getting into everything. And there's five of these accumulation zones on the planet. And we've sampled all of them, and all of them have the plastic in high concentration.
But you can't see it from a satellite. It's not just... Yeah, how does that look? What does a garbage look like?
You can see it from a drone because you can see the individual pieces of plastic. But once you get up too high, like to a satellite, the wavelets breaking on the surface of the ocean obscure this stuff, which is floating kind of lazily near the surface.
And it's not all whole items. They break down.
No, they break down rather quickly, and... not only that, you just simply can't penetrate the glare from the surface very well by satellite. The satellites are great for telling you how fast the wind is blowing because there's an algorithm that lets you know the reflectance of these wavelets breaking on the ocean. As the wavelets get bigger, their reflectance changes, and you can estimate the speed of the air that's causing that disturbance. So you get a good wind indicator out of a satellite picture of the ocean surface, but you don't get to see down into it to see what's there.
And how far down does it go?
It goes all the way to the bottom. It's throughout the water column, but the highest concentrations are at the top and the bottom because the heavier-than-water plastics are probably mostly near the coastline, although submersible divers see them on virtually every dive, no matter where they are, the bits and pieces. It's quite ubiquitous in the marine environment.
And how does the marine environment... interact with the plastic?
It interacts in a number of ways. One, by accumulating it. You know, the ocean's always knitting, as Dr. Ebbesmeyer says, and it takes like things and puts them with like. We had one sailor sail around the world, and every time he'd come to an island, he'd ask him where there was a trash beach. Most islands, the inhabitants know where the trash ends up on which beach. And he found that the trash beaches on these different islands accumulated different things. Some would have, like, balls and shoes, and others would have toothbrushes and, plastic chips. So that you find that the ocean kind of, even to the extent when they had that sneaker spill, the Nike track shoes that went overboard in a container separated right and left so that the beachcombers up in Oregon and Washington had to get together and have swap meets so that they could get pairs of shoes because the left shoe would go to one beach and the right shoe would go to another beach. So it sorts things out, but it also...
how does the sea life... I'm curious, how does the sea life interact with the garbage?
Yeah. The first thing it does is create a biofilm on it, which is bacteria living on the surface. Mm-hmm. Then that biofilm is habitat for organisms that settle out of the water column, the sessile organisms that attach to it, the barnacles, and then that brings the crabs, the pelagic crabs that swim around in the ocean. There are crabs that don't necessarily have to sit on a rock. There's crabs that can swim all their lives, but they do like to grab a hold of stuff. If you dive in out in the middle of these garbage patches, the crabs will start swimming towards you if you take away their trash. So we see a food chain building up on these things, and we're concerned about that because that I've actually got coral growing on them, seen that, sampled that. So what we think what we're creating is kind of a new coastline-type habitat with tide pools, equivalent of similar to tide pools, with the tides rather than being diurnal tides being more caused by storm action, so that the stuff's driven down and coming back up to the surface when it's calm and being driven down when it's rough. And this new habitat is bringing kind of creatures from the coast that didn't normally live out there and providing more habitat for the ones that did live out there that attached to these things. So it's basically changing the ecosystem. It's making a new artificial plastic reef out in the middle of these.
Oh, plastics. Well, we'll be right back to discuss what can be done about this problem on the food. Ooh. Well, folks, we're back talking about plastics in the ocean with Captain Moore. My question to you, Captain, is what is the effect on us of our garbage ending up in the ocean?
Well, you know, we really need to be a little more sophisticated in our thinking about this. Rather than, you know, thinking it's all about getting it back from the ocean into us, we also need to think about what's getting into us as the plastic is going on its way to the ocean. This plastic lifestyle, this plastic-covered lifestyle has got a number of effects on us before we ever lose it and get it back by eating fish or other seafood, which, you know, is now being grown in plastic cages and around the world. And aquaculture contributing about 50% now of the seafood to our stores. So the plastic is made by polymerizing monomers into polymers. Monomers are petroleum products that have the capacity to make unlimited chains of molecules stick together by the use of a catalyst. And even if you don't add anything, which frankly all plastics have additives which escape and get into us, you still have individual monomers. This is an industrial process. So you take styrene and make polystyrene and then make your styrofoam coffee cup. The scientists we're working with at Cal State University Long Beach did some studies on people's serum and found that their common denominator pollutant among all of them was styrene, because the individual styrene monomer was not 100% polymerized in the industrial process that made polystyrene out of styrene. So that leaching of the free monomers into whatever comes in contact with the polystyrene was causing this to appear in people's serum. This is happening throughout the plastic realm. Individual plastic monomers are getting into our bodies, and then there's the additives that make the plastic do what it wants. For instance, you've got to add bisphenol A into plastics to make them rigid, the polycarbonate. That was why we got rid of the Nalgene bottles, those rigid, strong, but really poison polycarbonate sports bottles are now been changed and they all say BPA-free, although a scientist collected everything labeled BPA-free that he could find for sale and found some of them have more of these estrogenic compounds leaching out than the BPA, had more active estrogen mimics than the EPA. Anyway, the additives, the nonylphenols that make them softer, the BPA that makes them harder, the flame retardants that make them, quote-unquote, safer, these are all showing up in our bodies in the plastic age before they ever get into the ocean. And when they get in the ocean, they leach out into the food system in the ocean. And then, of course, in a study done, say, for instance, in Singapore, every kind of seafood that the scientists looked at in all the markets, they just went and rounded up seafood of all types from the markets. Every single piece of it had BPA contamination. So it's everywhere. We're getting this stuff on the backside and on the front side.
Can the fish absorb the chemicals through their skin, or do they have to eat it?
Well, that's a pretty good question. I would think that there, you know, we see pictures of children swimming in Indian rivers, Indonesian rivers, that are so choked with plastic, they're actually swimming in plastic, on plastic, mm-hmm. with plastic. And there's got to be some leaching there, and there's got to be some transdermal absorption. But the major vector, I think, would be through ingestion, because what you do with ingestion is you change the pH, and that's what releases the pollutants. So you get those digestive juices flowing, and then you start to get more of the leaching of the monomers into the tissue. And just a month of being fed plastic pellets from Tokyo Bay, some shearwaters developed changes in their livers, high levels of PCBs, DDTs. And in a study done in San Diego Bay, California, one of the fish, the medaka, that was given plastic soaked in San Diego Bay water developed liver cancer.
Hmm. Well, we have a caller, Jan from San Lorenzo Valley. Jan, hello.
Hi. First off, I want to let you know your phone lines have been down during the whole show until now. I called and let them know, and they got it fixed.
But thank you.
My question to Mr. Moore is it possible to use this plastic as a resource? We're always looking for resources to make things. Is there a way to have ships go out and collect this, have some way to attract it to the hull of the ship so that when they come in the dock, you scrape it all off? And if we don't use it as a resource to make other things, can we just lock it up into big blocks of plastic and have a place where we put this?
I got a short answer for you. No.
Why is that? Because it's so small?
It's a handful of small plastic bits per football field, if you want to think of it that way. And there's no collection technology that can make a living collecting, you know, a couple of ounces. We found in a square kilometer in our 1999 study, 5,000 grams of plastic. That's 2.5 kilos of plastic in a square kilometer, you know. Now, that's just not enough to fuel any kind of a recovery effort. And you'd only be able to work in the daytime because at night the surface is full of life. The small fish, the mctophids, we were talking about what salmon eat. Salmon eat mctophids and squid. These are the two main food sources for them when they're out fattening up in the ocean. Mctophids are 55% of fish biomass. They're called lantern fish. They live their lives in darkness. And they leave as soon as the sun comes up. So they're working like crazy feeding on this zooplankton and phytoplankton that's been created during the daytime hours. You know, there's only life-giving plant growth during daylight hours out in the deep ocean. There's no upwelling from the bottom, and the only food there is created through sunlight, working with the impoverished nutrient load there in the surface waters of the gyre. And those fish are taking advantage of that at night.
We will be right back. All right, we're back. Thank you very much, Jan, for your call. We have Adam from SoCal on the line. Hello, Adam.
Yes, hello.
What's your question?
My question to Captain Moore is, I was in the Merchant Marines in the 1980s, and throughout the maritime experience, there was never really any emphasis on dealing with trash. And so essentially when you're at sea, you're always throwing trash overboard. And I'm wondering, is Captain Moore experiencing anything in industry that's basically trying to further it so that mariners are no longer trained to just throw trash over the side?
Good question.
Yeah, the Navy, we worked with the folks at the Natick Soldier Center to study biodegradable plastics and marine degradable plastics. And as part of that effort to research how not to be such bad stewards of the ocean, they've created the PRIME project, Plastic Reduction in the Marine Environment, PRIME, and they are soliciting suppliers that don't have individual packages wrapped in plastic. They're looking at ways to reduce the plastic in the ocean, and they're looking at materials like the PLA plastics, the polylactic acid, which doesn't biodegrade in the ocean, and the PHA plastic, the polyhydroxyalkanoate plastic, that will degrade in the marine environment, and seeing what they can make out of those kind of materials. So there is efforts in the Navy itself, although if you saw the movie about the captain who was captured by the Somali pirates, Captain Phillips, in the book, his captain's duty, he reports that when he was with the pirates and they were negotiating with the Navy ship, there was a scare. They saw at night some black shapes floated by, and they were getting ready to shoot Captain Phillips, thinking it was some kind of Navy SEAL action, when actually they got on the radio and the captain said, no, there was no threat to you. It was just our trash. So even in the recent history of the Navy, when they're not, don't have the facilities and have trash accumulate and they're out at sea for a long time, they'll still throw it over. Now, accidental loss of plastic is not covered under the MARPOL agreement, which prohibits dumping plastic anywhere at sea. So anytime you can make an excuse that whatever you dropped overboard was dropped accidentally, you're off scot-free. So there's very few prosecutions under MARPOL, which is the International Maritime Organization's prohibition against dumping plastic.
All right. Well, thank you, Adam, for the call. Thank you, Captain Moore. One last question. Is it possible to throw plastic away?
No, there's no, a way is not a place. The space is now littered with plastic.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Captain Moore, founder of the Algolita Marine Research Institute and author of Plastic Oceans. And thank you for tuning in. We hope to see you all next week for more of What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. And remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
And a big thank you, Kelly Bayer, for being a producer on the Food Chain. And best of luck to you as you go out there into the world. Really appreciate your assistance.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.